dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has distinguished himself in a variety of capacities in that war over decades, notably as one of the duty experts on the Middle East and specifically places like Turkey and Iran in the Office of the Secretary of Defense for, well, several decades, I think it's fair to say, is Dr. Harold Rode. He has been a guest on this program frequently. He is an author of books that we have published at the Center for Security Policy Press. He is also a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute and a great friend and much admired colleague. He is with us today to talk a bit about Turkey and what it is doing at the moment in Syria and what the implications are for the region and perhaps the wider world beyond. Dr. Rode, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, the pleasure may be diminished somewhat because of the things we have to talk about today. I wanted to start, if I could, just as a point of calibration, Harold, by talking about Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, who called President Trump, or spoke with President Trump at least, last weekend. That set the stage for an invasion that, as we speak, is underway, involving attacks on Kurdish forces and sites. We're told some Christian sites as well. Tell us about the man and tell us what you make of the call that set this in train.
Well, let's say, to start with, I'm confused. I admire President Trump, but I don't get this one. President Erdogan, dictator Erdogan, because he really can do what he wants, is no friend of the United States. He's no friend of the West. He's a Muslim fundamentalist. And he wants, basically, to first control the Muslim world and then continue on and take over Europe and the world. Now, I know this sounds fanciful because we in the West can't imagine people thinking this way, but we don't really understand the Muslim view of the world, but that is his. 80, 90, whatever years ago it was, the caliphate in Istanbul was ended by Atatürk, who founded modern Turkey, or from the Middle Eastern point of view, America and the Europeans really ended it. And what Erdogan is simply trying to do is reestablish it. This sounds fanciful, but that is how he thinks.
And when you say the caliphate, that obviously has a connotation in terms of the traditions of Islam, but it has some very bad history for an awful lot of other people. Muslim, frankly, as well as non-Muslim. Do you anticipate, based on, again, not conjecture or, you know, your own musings on the subject, but what Erdogan himself has said on the subject, that he envisions incursions like the one underway at the moment in Syria as just part of this reconstitution of the Ottoman Empire or some sort of caliphate under his rule?
That's right. Look, what he wants to do, if I understand correctly, is enter this area, clean it out of all of the Kurds, and bring Arab Sunnis, Arabs, who are originally Syrian, who are in Turkey, and forcibly move them into that area to build cities, to build villages. So we will have a buffer between him and the Kurds of northern Syria of about 30 kilometers, let's say 16 miles or so in, and about 300 miles more or less long, that is east-west. Now, this is what he wants to do. whether he'll succeed is another story. I don't know where the money is going to come to build all of these things. The Turkish economy is in shambles, largely due to Erdogan and his, how he's wasting money. But that's what he wants to do. But see, in the Middle East, and we may think of Turkey as part of Europe and part of NATO, it's really not. It's formally part of NATO, but really it is. Turkey is a Middle Eastern country. And people don't forget. And the moment they see weakness, they pounce. And what happened here is by President Trump withdrawing, it may be just a few people, it doesn't matter. He is signaling from Northeastern Syria, he is signaling that America is abandoning its only true Muslim ally in the entire Muslim world. The Kurds have been with the United States for decades already now. We have worked closely together. They have relied on us, and we have relied on them. They were the fighters, basically, against ISIS. We did things from the air, but it was the Kurds who did the fighting on the ground. Now, what is interesting is Erdogan has a long history of supporting ISIS. Now, we don't want to see that, but he is the one who has allowed them to go back and forth into Syria, into Iraq. And he's, at best, we could say he looked the other way. In the Middle East, they don't look the other way. They know exactly what's going on. And Erdogan's interest and Erdogan's interest have not been the same, which makes it even more difficult for me to understand why President Trump abandoned our only true ally again in the Muslim world, the Kurds.
Obviously, Harold Rode, and I want to sort of back the lens up here momentarily, but the implications of abandoning allies extends far beyond the attitude of those most immediately affected. But just for the moment, staying with Turkey, staying with the operation in Syria, would you anticipate that the Turks envision this being a temporary arrangement, this safe zone, as you might call it, buffer zone? Or is this really part and parcel, given what you've said about Erdogan's ambitions, of a more permanent carving out and ultimately domination of not only this part of neighboring Syria, but presumably other parts of that area as well?
I think, unfortunately, your second thing is correct. I think there's nothing temporary about this. Again, we can't know the future. But looking at overall what Erdogan's goals, that is that. Erdogan, I must say, actually has a few enemies here. When he started his invasion, and that's really what it does, of taking territory which is not part of Turkey and has no historical relationship with Turkey. It was in the Ottoman Empire, but that's a long time ago, and it's not Turkey. The Iranians are very, very upset here, and Zarif, their foreign minister, doesn't have much power, truthfully, but he criticized the Turkish invasion. This has two problems for him. Erdogan will most likely, because this is who he is, will support, again, ISIS moving back into that area. Those are his people. They have the same role.
Hey, Harold, let me interrupt you because I'd like to pick up on both of these two points, and I'm out of time. So let's take a break. We're talking with Dr. Harold Rode. We'll talk with him more about what's happening on the ground in Syria at the moment, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for a second bite at the apple with Dr. Harold Rode, our friend and colleague, the author of Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On, from the Center for Security Policy Press. You can check it out at securefreedom.org. Indeed, you can download it for free there. I commend it to you very strongly. Harold has long experience with Turkey, with Iran, with the Middle East more generally, including service in the Office of Net Assessment, and as a specialist on these matters for the Defense Department for many years. Harold, thank you again for your time today. You are just beginning to draw out some of the insights that the rest of the region is taking from this turn of events in Syria, as the Turks are now, with the acquiescence, it would seem, of President Trump, at least moving in force into parts of Syria?
Yes. First of all, Erdogan is a Sunni, and he hates Shiites. Iran is Shiite. And by him marching into this area, and he, in the past, and there's no reason to think he'll do anything differently now, he has supported ISIS fighters. So now we cleaned the place out, we and the Kurds together. The Kurds aren't going to help us anymore on that one. So when these guys come in, the natural enemy of these people is Iran, because Iran is Shiite. And Zarif, the foreign minister, has already condemned Turkey for going in there. This is part of this particular aspect of the general Shiite Sunni war, which includes Iran, Saudi Arabia on one hand, and the Houthis in Yemen. They're Shiites, a slightly different type, but they're still Shiites. There's a war going on all throughout the Middle East between the Shiites and the Sunnis, because problems are never, never solved. They're just put into the background. There's no even concept in any of these languages of solving. Solving really means in negotiation, you know what's important to you and you know what you can give up, and the other side is the same. You try to negotiate where you get your essentials met and you give in on the others and you get an agreement. This in the Middle East is absent, because everything, it's an all or a nothing thing. I have to win, you lose, or vice versa.
At best, you get these what are called hudnas, I guess, where you have a sort of temporary ceasefire.
That's it.
So, Harold, let me just ask you, one of the complexities of this is that for some time now, the Turks have been doing business with the Iranians, among other things, helping them avoid sanctions. But I understand that there's this underlying dynamic of Shiite versus Sunni, and we're told that the Iranians have been trying to sort of import Shiites into Syria to change sort of the demography of the place. The Turks presumably are trying to do the same. And in the mix of all of this, we've got, of course, the Sunni, well, Sharia supremacists of the Islamic State. So are you saying that under these circumstances, that sort of modus vivendi between Turkey and Iran is probably off, at least for the time being, and they will be perhaps coming to blows in the course of this invasion and its aftermath?
No. Here's why. In the Middle East, people are constantly, at one hand, they may hate their enemy, and then they're also trading with them. This, to us, is a sort of an oxymoron, but that's how it works in the Middle East. Erdogan hates Israel with a passion, and the trade with Israel keeps increasing. There are at least one, sometimes two flights a day from Israel to Istanbul, and people use Istanbul as a transit point. It doesn't make sense, because Erdogan wants constantly, he wants to destroy Israel. He says the most awful things about it. It's almost like the Iranians, but yet they trade. So in the Middle East, look, the Kurds and Bashar al-Assad, the guy who runs whatever the rump state of Syria is, they want very different things. Yet Assad was buying Kurdish oil, and the Kurds were selling it to him. This, unfortunately, is normal in the Middle East. I can do business with you and at the same time try to kill you. Now, this, again, it's not how we in the West think about the world, but it is the way they do it.
Yeah. And the way they do it is, as you said, Harold Road, very much informed by long memories. And I want to just get you to address kind of the implications of the perception that the United States has abandoned people who work with them, some would argue work for us, notably in this fight against the Islamic State. How is that being perceived by not only the Turks and the Iranians, but let's talk about the Russians. Let's talk about the Syrians and the Israelis, for that matter. You're there in Israel now. What's the view from the ground towards this very dramatic shift?
Well, one of the things that the greatest scholar of the Middle East of the 20th century, late 20th century, Bernard Lewis used to say, America is unfortunately again demonstrating that it is a harmless enemy and an unreliable ally. And this is why you are seeing all over the Gulf right now delegations going to Tehran to talk with the Iranians, because they're saying to themselves they can't trust America. Frank, I hate what I'm saying, but this is the reality. Now, when you send a delegation, if I come to visit you, Frank, you're the senior guy, I'm the junior guy. That's how they understand it in the Middle East. If I come to you, I'm a supplicant, I'm begging from you. And that's what our Gulf allies and friends are doing right now. You ask about Russia. Russia is in Syria helping Bashar al-Assad and the Shiites. It doesn't like Iran. That's another story. But the mere fact that the Sunnis, that Erdogan, is going into northern Syria is a bad thing for Russia because of Russia's own Muslim problem. This is going to sound fanciful, but in Moscow itself, about one-third of the city is either legally or illegally resident are Muslims from the former Soviet Union. That's a huge number. And they're almost all, not all, but almost all Sunni. There are a few Shiites. There's basically the Azerbaijanis, nobody else. And the Russians have a very serious problem with Sunni Islam. And the fact that Erdogan is now trying to bring back Sunnis, that's what he wants to do, Sunni Arabs, into Syria, where Putin saw it as like his, what he's trying to do is build up. This is bad for Russia. It hurts. It hurts Syria. And it hurts Iran, which is sort of an erstwhile, but not really an ally of Russia. So this, it becomes, it's a much larger picture. And if you don't mind, from a world point of view, everybody is watching what America is doing with its friends and allies. And unfortunately, what has happened is that America is proving again and again that it is unreliable. When the Shah fell in Iran, we didn't do anything to help him. When the Israelis basically fled from southern Lebanon, Israel is part of the West, Israel abandoned a lot of its allies. This is not the way to do things in the Middle East. If you and I have a relationship, it's like we're brothers, same blood. We must help each other. You don't abandon allies. And the way it looks right now is that's what President Trump did in northeastern Syria. I don't want to say what I'm saying.
No, I understand. None of us find this appetizing, Harold, but we've got to speak truthfully about how this is going down. And let me ask you about Israel. Obviously, it is increasingly, I think, rightly concerned about the encroachment of Iran in Syria and the buildup of its forces in Lebanon through Hezbollah. And, you know, the likelihood that Iran will use Syria as a point from which to attack Israel. It's done some of that already. But is Israel likely to try to make separate peaces as well with the Russians or with others who may enable it to reduce somewhat its reliance on the United States under these circumstances?
Israel is a different issue. And let me tell you, this is a fascinating, I'm in Jerusalem right now, and it's a fascinating discussion. And all the commentators have opinions here, and most have known based on zero knowledge and zero facts. Let me say the following. President Trump has said that he's tired defending other people. They got to take care of themselves. As Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, has said over and over again, the Middle East is an extremely messy place. What is the difference between Israel and everybody else here? Israel doesn't rely on anybody else and doesn't want to rely on anybody else to take care of itself. It only wants its own troops to defend Israel. That fits in line with at least what President Trump is saying. I hope it continues that way. But the other thing is that Israel has, in the United States, an enormous support group. The largest are evangelical Christians, and they are unswervingly committed to Israel's existence. I want to say much more than a lot, especially of the liberal Jews in the United States. An evangelical Christian matter to President Trump for his reelection effort. I'm not a politics guy. I'm a culture guy, and I'm a Muslim culture guy. But if you add to that the fact that Israel doesn't want foreign troops, doesn't want Americans to defend it. Israel wants to defend itself so it can make its own military decisions that it must. And so Israel, therefore, is in a different category than the rest of America's friends in the Middle East.
No, I take that point, Harold. And I think that what we're looking at is a situation in which, thank God, Israel can be self-reliant. But they've got to be very, very anxious about what is happening in Syria in any event. And that's a key point that we mustn't lose sight of. Harold, we have to let you go with that for the moment. Thank you, Harold. We'll look forward to your updates on this. Thank you for taking the time to join us today under these very difficult circumstances. We look forward to a further visit with you.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a delight to say we're joined by a man that I've come to admire enormously for his insights into and his extraordinarily dedicated work in connection with the problems arising for our society, for our security, for our public safety, from the vulnerabilities of our electric grid. His name is Thomas Popick. He is the president and co-founder of an absolutely indispensable organization, the Foundation for Resilient Societies, which has dedicated its time and energies and resources towards raising awareness about the problems with our grid, as it's called, and the various ways in which those problems can be ameliorated. I've learned enormously from Tom Popick over the years and have been very proud to have him as one of our founding members of the Secure the Grid Coalition, which under the leadership of my colleague Tommy Waller has done incalculably important work, much of it informed by and indeed enabled by Tom Popick and his colleagues at the Foundation for Resilient Society. Tom formerly served as an officer rising to the rank of captain in the United States Air Force. He has a master's of business administration from Harvard Business School and an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering from MIT, the sorts of qualifications that have made him such an extraordinary resource for us and so many others with respect to this issue of the grid. Tom Popick, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. It's wonderful to be with you.
Well, I have to say it's wonderful to be with you, too, except for this natty problem that we're watching play out in Northern California at the moment. Evidence of a disastrous vulnerability of our electric grid in that part of the country, namely what Pacific Gas and Electric, better known by its initials PG&E, have done or, well, as importantly, not done to mitigate some serious vulnerabilities. Talk to us about what's happening at the moment and the symptoms of the problem that are now confronting, I guess it's well over a million residents of Northern California.
Well, certainly. What's happening at the moment is there's high winds in California. When the wind blows, trees and vegetation contact high voltage transmission lines, there are sparks that fly, and this can cause a fire. There's been fires that have been caused in the past in California by this. And PG&E, as a matter of fact, they're in bankruptcy right now because of a very significant event that occurred a year ago, the so-called Camp Fire. Now they're taking a different approach, which is to simply shut down the transmission lines on warning of high winds to prevent fires. Of course, when you shut down transmission and distribution lines, you black out people. And that's the essence of the situation right now in California with over a million people blacked out.
I heard a PG&E spokesman quoted this morning apologizing for any inconvenience that might arise. As I understand it, Tom Popeck, this blackout, this voluntary blackout, not caused by some act of nature or other terrorist incident or what have you, but at the direction of the company, may last for as long as a week. And as men who studied these issues closely, could you give us a sense, those of us who happily don't live in the affected area, a sense of the nature, the magnitude, and the perhaps life and death implications of this so-called inconvenience?
Well, certainly. There are people who have medical equipment that depend on electric power. So, for example, diabetics need their insulin refrigerated. Their insulin needs to be refrigerated. There are people with CPAP machines. These are breathing devices to help people breathe in the night. Those require electricity. Pharmacies, a lot of people have prescriptions that they need filled on an urgent basis. Pharmacies without power will be closed. So that there, we can even put hospitals in there. A lot of hospitals have backup generators. The backup generators don't always work.
And even if they do work, they need to be refueled after a couple of days, don't they?
They do need to be refueled. The bigger problem with the hospital generators is often, and any diesel generators, the fuel degrades over time. And if it's not used, then it really isn't used because there's environmental regulations that prevent the generators from using up the fuel. So it has to be periodically cleaned. And if that cleaning isn't done correctly, then the filters will clog when they're called upon, when the generators are called upon. So that's why in past events, about a third of the backup generators have failed to start or have malfunctioned shortly after being called upon.
Wow. But Tom, just to this larger point, now, obviously, if it's only a week's duration, this may not be as critical as it would be for a more protracted blackout. But you need to get fuel to replace the fuel that's consumed by these. I guess in a case where it's a localized blackout, albeit one that's fairly large in size, you can be bringing in fuel from elsewhere. But the point is that the ripple effects of these blackouts is something that most of us don't contemplate. And we're going to be watching a million people in our own state of California sort of being subjected involuntarily to sort of the guinea pigs of grid down circumstances, even if it's just for a week. That's a lot of time and a lot of people affected. No,
certainly this may come as a surprise to people in California who have been blacked out, but the effects of this blackout are tiny compared to what could happen to California. These are blackouts mostly at the distribution level. So one street is blacked out, the next street still has power. People can seek refuge in hotels or with friends and relatives. The bigger threat for California is that about two-thirds of California's energy for electricity is imported over the state line. About one-third of it is power that is generated in other states, and another third is natural gas that is used to fire generation plants in California. If that long-distance energy supply chain were to be interrupted, California would be in an extraordinarily difficult position, not only for electricity, but also for water, because the water is pumped over mountains using electric pumps. So this blackout, as serious as it is for some people that are dependent on electricity for their medical needs, it is very small in implications to what could affect California.
Yeah. And Tom, one of the reasons why this is edifying is that PG&E owned the large transformer substation outside of San Jose, California, that was attacked back in 2013, as I recall. And had it not been, by the grace of God, for what seems to have been an oversight by the attackers, cutting one last strand in the communications to an offsite control center, we might well have seen the kind of impact on Northern California that you were just warning about. And it's a failure of PG&E to have appreciably mitigated that problem that, again, bespeaks this larger concern that I think a lot of us have about that particular utility not doing what needs to be done to make the grid as resilient as it can possibly be. This is the focus, of course, of your organization, the Foundation for Resilient Societies. But I did want, before we run out of time, for you just to say a word about how the problem is not confined just to this utility, or indeed just to utilities across the nation when it comes to a lack of ameliorative actions. Talk a little bit, if you would, about some of the problems you've been confronting and working on with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as it relates to its ability to require these sorts of improvements in resiliency.
Well, certainly. We have a system of mandatory electric reliability and security standards in the United States, but the details of that system are woefully inadequate. The standards have many loopholes and exemptions, and also the enforcement has been very spotty. I'm looking at a list of violations of the standard for vegetation management, and I see all the way back in 2009, Pacific Gas and Electric Company was fined $100,000 for violation of the vegetation management standard.
Vegetation management, of course, is bureaucraties for pruning of trees, right? I mean, that do you need a standard for that?
Tree trimming, right. And I'm looking at the NERC records, and that's the North American Electric Reliability Corporation records. I see the violation risk factor for that 2009 violation is high. So it's certainly true that PG&E has had many, many management challenges with tree trimming, with physical security, as you mentioned, with the Metcalf attack, also with cybersecurity. They had a major cybersecurity breach, information breach several years ago. But what is really difficult for the public is there's been a lack of transparency, not just for PG&E, but for many, many major utilities in the country that have violated mandatory reliability standards, and these violations have been covered up. The way they're covered up is through confidential dockets at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. This practice is not serving the public interest at all, and it really needs to be remedied.
To the contrary, I mean, you're being very understated here, Tom Popick. It is putting the American people in mortal peril. It's more than a disservice. It is endangering the public safety, and indeed, I would argue, the national security more generally. And that's why the work that you do at the Foundation for Resilient Societies, Tom, is so vital, and why we appreciate so much your visits with us from time to time, and particularly helping to put into context what the devil is taking place in Northern California at the moment at the hands of PG&E, and what we need to do about not just that problem, but the resiliency of our grid more generally. Come back to us soon, Tom, with updates, if you would. Thank you, though, for your time today.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Brigadier General Robert Spalding, now retired from his great service to our country in the United States Air Force, as a pilot of B-52 Stratofortresses, as well as B-2 Spirit aircrafts, among many other things. In fact, he became, during his time in uniform, one of the military's preeminent experts on China, including as a result of a tour as the defense attaché there. His last duty station in the Air Force was a special assistant to the Air Force Vice Chief of Staff, with responsibility for thinking through what our strategic vision and response to China was. He also served as a strategic planner at the National Security Council prior to that. Rob Spalding, it is very good to have you back. I think this is the first time I can say congratulations on your splendid new book, Stealth War, How China Took Over While America Slept. We're going to have you back on for a longer conversation about it, but I'm very appreciative of your time for a brief interview today.
Absolutely. Great to be here, Frank. Thanks.
The immediate focus of this brief interview is there is a report that President Trump has made a decision to allow Huawei, this Chinese company, conglomerate, telecommunications giant, however you wish to describe it, to resume its purchases of some American telecommunications equipment. You have been probably as vocal and vociferous an opponent of Huawei as anybody in America. Tell us what you make of this decision and remind us why the stakes are so high with respect to this company.
Well, so first of all, I haven't heard that, quite frankly, I would be surprised because we're not selling anything to Huawei that's on the export control list. We are selling things to Huawei, but nothing that's on the export control list. And I don't think there's been a change in that. And I don't think there will be a change in that because it has nothing to do with the trade deal. It has everything to do with national security. So, and what we're talking about is high-end computer chips, field programmable gate arrays, things that are used, quite frankly, also in military equipment that we're not selling to them. So if there's a change in that, I would be extremely surprised, since Huawei is a national security threat to the United States, not just a company. It is essentially an arm of, because of the way the People's Liberation Army and the Ministry of State Security work integrally with with Huawei, it is an arm of the Communist Party.
I think you're probably right that the policy is not changing to enable us to send militarily appropriate equipment to Huawei. But are you concerned that we're doing anything to help this company succeed and prosper and extend its proliferation of its technologies and the dependency thereon around the world, even if it's not directly militarily relevant?
Well, I'm certainly concerned, Frank, but you know, the more important problem and what I've been trying to get going in this country is the idea that we need our own strategy. We need our own telecommunications capability in secure 5G, and we need to build it here in this country, and we need to build it in other democracies. We need to shore up our digital defenses, quite frankly, which are down. So we have a great Air Force, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, but digitally, you know, the People's Liberation Army is all over our country. And if we don't get them out, and if we don't get them out of the countries of our allies and partners, we're done. Now, you can say Huawei's not going to build a network, but then Ericsson and Nokia are partnering with China and having Chinese manufacture their equipment. Their code base has code from China. Quite frankly, a lot of the technology was designed by Chinese companies that they're building into their network equipment as well. And so we actually need to have a proactive strategy with regard to building a secure 5G network. And quite frankly, we can. We have the technology. It's in the Defense Department and in the intelligence communities. It hasn't been commercialized, but we've spent billions of dollars investing in it. All we need to do is roll it out on a nationwide secure network and then give that security in the digital space, like we protect America's skies and the seas and the land with our military. We need to protect the digital space as well. That's the difference.
Yeah. I know you've addressed this at length in the new book, Stealth War, Rob Spalding, as well as, you know, in your public service, notably at the National Security Council and, of course, at the Defense Department. What is the impediment to doing what you've just described? Is it money? And if it is, you've recently participated in a really important statement for which I'm very grateful with several other prominent and influential veterans like yourself, opposing the idea of having your military retirement money and that of others of us who worked in the civilian or military aspects of our government used to fund Chinese companies, if not Huawei, then certainly others like it that are very problematic. If that money is instead vectored towards American companies and investments, presumably that would not be an impediment. But is it the money or is it national vision and leadership? What's the impediment to us having the kind of 5G network that we need to compete with, well, immediately Huawei, but more to the point, the People's Liberation Army for which it works?
It's money. It is national leadership and vision. It is also the telecom industry and the tech industry who according to their business model, want to sell your data to the highest bidder. So they don't want to provide a secure, encrypted internet for you that manages your identity and allows for access control in a way that prevents the People's Liberation Army from getting access to your data. They don't want that because it would change their business model. And then finally, in the telecom industry, the AT&T and Verizon are hundreds of billions of dollars in debt. They don't want to invest in a nationwide secure 5G network. And so that's why they had me pushed out of the White House.
This is the crux of the problem, it seems to me, is that we've got globalists in corporate leadership that have long since lost sight of the fundamentals of national security. And I think this is true particularly on Wall Street. And one of the reasons why there's now trillions of dollars that are available to, if not actually being used by, the Chinese communists to build up their corporate capabilities, some of which are being applied to weapon systems with which to kill our men and women in uniform, among others of us. It's just stunning. I did want to close by asking you very quickly, Rob, I don't know that you've seen it, but you're familiar with the line of argument. Farhad Manjoo, who is a op-ed opinion columnist for the New York Times, has written a piece entitled, "Dealing with China Isn't Worth the Moral Costs." It has the subtitle, "We thought economic growth and technology would liberate China. Instead, it corrupted us." To what extent is that what's going on here, Rob Spalding, as you've seen it from both inside government and now out?
Well, you know, I would have said that Farhad nicely summarized the book Stealth War that I just wrote. And essentially, that's what it's about. It's about, you know, in the past, we thought that America could be conquered by a foe that would use the sea, the air, and the land to attack us. And what we failed to see is that they had devised this scheme to use finance, economics, and digital lines of communication to essentially undermine our society from within. The perfect example most recently of that is what happened with the NBA when they essentially capitulated to the Chinese Communist Party.
Right. It's epic in that regard. And Rob, though, as you're looking at this, we've got the companies, we've got the investment houses, we've got technology firms in Silicon Valley who are throwing in with the Chinese, even in ways that are clearly inimical to the vital interests of this country and to our, well, fundamentally our security. What would you say to those companies now that might, if they were to read your book specifically, but might prompt them to get back on team with America?
Well, what I could tell them is what's happening in the federal government right now is a change, a monumental change, probably the biggest change that has happened since the end of the Cold War. And if they've got money, if they've got business in China, if they have financial interests there, and they aren't minimizing that, you know, in the next couple of years, they're going to find the losses that they incur as a result of that behavior are going to come back to haunt them.
Well, Rob Spalding, thank you for your service to our country, both in uniform and that you're providing these days at the Hudson Institute. And I hope you come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.